Today's Bible reading is from Exodus 2, 1-25. Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with fir and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at the hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What did I must have come known?" When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water the father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to the rescue and watered their flock. When the girls returned to rule their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "And where is he?" Reuel asked his daughters, "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in a marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I become a foreigner in a foreign land." During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in the slavery and cried out, and the cry for help because of the slavery went up to God. God heard the groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them.
Thanks, Scott. So keep that reading in front of you. I came across a photograph recently, if you put that up for us, Graham. Life is pain. Someone scrawled this on this beautiful plain wall. Life is pain. Well, that's a bit depressing, isn't it? A bit defeatist. I mean, sure, life has lots of pain in it. But is that all there is to life? Is that sort of the defining feature of our lives? Well, apparently not everyone thinks so, because someone else came along and changed it to this. Life is pain au chocolat. Now, if you don't know what a pan, you're Australian, so I'll forgive you for not knowing what a pan au chocolat is. It's kind of like a croissant with chocolate in it, often consumed with hot chocolate. In other words, life isn't pain. Life is sweet. Life is good to be savoured and enjoyed. Well, who's got it right? Is life pain or pan au chocolat? On the whole, I think our experience is a bit of both. But the real question is, where is God in this? Where is God when life is pain, when life is bad? Does that mean God is sleeping on the job? And where is God when things are great, going great? Well, this is our second week looking at Exodus. So just to sort of orientate you, we're 400 years after God had kept Abram's descendants safe from famine through Joseph. He became second in command of Egypt, saving the whole region from famine, being a blessing to the nations, just as God had promised Abraham. 400 years later, the Israelites have increased greatly in number, just as God had promised. But Joseph is long forgotten, and the new Pharaoh doesn't see the increase of Israelites as blessing. He sees them as curse. He sees them as a threat. So far, all his attempts to curse them, to limit them, have not only have they not worked, they've worked against him. They've backfired. And as well, just another pattern, I forgot to mention this last week, another pattern you kind of see is, in Genesis, God begins the book front and center. You know, in the beginning, God, and you see him directly present, directly involved, visibly. And then as the Genesis goes on, he kind of seems to go still working, still acting, but more in the background, behind the scenes. So front and center kind of shrinks into the background. Exodus, we'll see, reverses that. So as we looked at chapter 1 last week, God is obviously at work. But if you were someone this was happening to, you'd probably be wondering why God isn't there, why God isn't doing anything. And yet by the end of Exodus, God's voice has been heard on Mount Sinai and his presence is directly with his people in a special way. That's just a pattern to look out for. So chapter 1, we've seen God pulling the levers behind the scenes. And today in chapter 2, we meet Moses. Moses. And I've called today's talk Special Delivery because the first step God takes to being more directly involved with his people is through making this man Moses his special deliverer. Working through Moses is his representative to deliver his people out of slavery and on a journey to their own land. So we're going to see how these events in chapter 2 point back to God's saving work already and point forward to the amazing things God is going to do through Moses and ultimately point forward to how God will rescue all of us through Jesus. Now that last part, this is about Jesus, you might think, well, that's a bit of a stretch. But again, last week we saw Paul says in Romans, these words were written for us, for our encouragement, so that we can be sure of the hope we have on promise. And the resurrected Jesus himself on the road to Emmaus, well, look, this is what happened, Luke 24:27, talking to some disciples, and beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. So Jesus himself talking about how possibly these very words, God's just read to us, are about him. So with that in mind, there's an outline in your leaflet. I won't read that out. There's sort of four headings. First two are the longer ones. So first of all, Moses is born and delivered. Delivered and delivered, I suppose. As we join people, God's people in Exodus, God's promises to Abram that his offspring will be blessed, well, they look a bit far from being fulfilled. Pharaoh's failed to curb the Hebrews' reproductive rate, but still, they're under terrible oppression in harsh slave work. And as if that's not bad enough, at the end of chapter 1, verse 22, then Pharaoh gave the order to all his people, Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. In other words, end the Hebrews' lifeline by throwing them into Egypt's lifeline, the Nile. And it's into this unpromising scenario that God begins his next phase of keeping his promises with the birth of Moses. So have a look at verse 1. A few details to notice. Moses is a Levite. Now, looking forward, the Levites will be priests, the sort of go-between between God and his people. And later, God will commission Moses to be like God to Pharaoh, to be his mediator. But looking back at Genesis to the Levites, well, it's a bit of a surprise, because it's Judah, the Jacob's son Judah, it's his line we're expecting a great leader from. And Levi actually had a reputation for causing big problems by being hot-headed, rash, violent, vengeful. So perhaps this is being a Levite is highlighted to show us he isn't God's ultimate deliverer, and it's helping us to understand why Moses ends up on the run later on in the chapter. Also, notice verse 1, he was fine. Now, I think every parent thinks that their baby looks fine, don't they? Oh, yes, he really does look like a baby. Yeah, they all kind of look the same, don't they? Well, the word fine here is the same word for good that God declares creation to be in Genesis 1. Good. So it's telling us that Moses will be on the side of God's creation purposes. He's on God's side, on the opposite team to Pharaoh's decreating. But imagine if you're Moses' mum at this point. What about these promises of blessing? I mean, you'd be thinking, what a joke. I mean, oh yeah, how blessed am I to give birth to a baby boy just as having a baby boy becomes illegal? Sentenced to death for existing, for being the wrong ethnic group. And Pharaoh gives this order to all his people, so everyone's got their eyes on what babies are being born. And yet she manages to hide him for 3 months from everyone. Good God, I couldn't hide a baby for 3 minutes, never mind 3 months. But soon enough, it's too hard. And so, actually, if you notice, technically, she fulfills Pharaoh's decree. She puts the baby in the Nile. Verse 3. When she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it, put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. A papyrus basket. Now, the word for basket, translated as basket, tabat in Hebrew, that word is only used in one other place in the Old Testament. And it's used for another structure that was coated in tar and pitch. You guess what it is? Noah's Ark. So the word basket there, she got a papyrus ark for him. So this triple connection between the rescue of Moses as an infant and Noah's famous rescue, Genesis 6 to 8, you can read about Noah. First, both are spared from God by God from dying in water. Second, both are placed in an ark. And in both cases, their arks carry them to safety while others are being destroyed. And third, both Moses and Noah are leaders through who God creates for himself a new people. So in the Bible, water for drinking is a symbol of life. You know, Jesus calls himself living water. But bodies of water in the Bible, uncontrolled water, well, their danger is emphasized. They're symbolic of judgment and death. If you go down under the water and don't come back up, then you'll die. Now, Moses here, even as a baby, isn't going around the danger of the water. He's going into the water, through the water of death and judgment, but is brought to safety, rescued. And not just from any old body of water, from the Nile, the source of Egypt's wealth and influence, the reason they're a superpower at the time. Moses goes into the symbolic heart of Egypt's power, comes out safely, comes out on top. So already, we're only in chapter 2, and we've already anticipated the delivery and the rescue through water God will do through Moses through the Red Sea later on when they escape Egypt. God bringing his people safely through judgment. So to sum up where we're up to by the time we get to verse 10, Moses is saved by Pharaoh's order being carried out, technically. Not only that, by Pharaoh's own daughter, rescuing the very child that will help make all Pharaoh's worst fears come true. Not only that, he's initially raised by his own mother at the expense of Pharaoh's daughter. Where is God in this? And not only is Moses rescued, he's prepared as a young man in the ways of the Egyptian court, ready for his work of dealing with Pharaoh later. Stephen in Acts 7 says this: Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. It becomes a prince of Egypt. So with the benefit of hindsight, we can see God at work amazingly, not just putting all the pieces in place to redeem his people, but also artfully pointing forward to how he will do that. And in the process, making a mockery of the human powers that oppose him, his plans and his people. But would the people in the story at that time have seen all that? When we're in the midst of our own struggles, we often won't be able to see what God is up to. Nobody looking on at Jesus on the cross could imagine that such a sordid, miserable, dark, defeated, humiliating moment was actually the turning point of history, the key moment of God's good plans for us being fulfilled. When we're in it ourselves, when we're in the pain, we don't have to be able to understand or explain everything. We don't have to like everything. We can cry out to God like his people back then did. Because it's not a cry of pure complaint. It's a cry of trust and dependence on God. That kind of cry he always hears. So Moses grows up, and whatever Moses has been through, he still sees himself as a Hebrew. And it leads to Moses' mini exodus. That's our next heading. Moses' mini exodus. Because like Moses before him, Moses has ended up on the inside of the Egyptian ruling class, hasn't he? He's in Pharaoh's palace. And if we didn't know what was coming next, we'd be thinking, great, this must be God's plan. He's got one of his own people on the inside, just like Joseph, finding favor with Pharaoh, softening his heart to God's people so that they're blessed, just like Joseph did. But no, there's to be no repeat of that history. Verse 11. One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them hard at their labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. So it's all come to this. He's a prince of Egypt, but he's been thinking about who he is as a Hebrew. Well, which one's going to win out? Verse 12. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Pharaoh finds out and Moses goes on his own exodus into the wilderness on the run, settling 300 kilometers away in Midian. Midian. So the Midianites will later become Israel's enemies. They're the ones that hire Balaam to curse Israel. And Moses ends up married with a son, verse 22, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, I have become a foreigner in a foreign land. He essentially calls his son asylum seeker or refugee as a reflection of the situation he finds himself in. So how is he going to rescue Israel from there? Has Moses messed up all of God's plans. Well, no, once again, there's a lot here about Moses' early life that anticipates what God is going to do through him. But just as Moses rescued the Israelite being beaten by the Egyptian, so in the near future, he's going to deliver the Israelites from the Egyptian oppressors on a big scale. And what helps us to be confident that this is the message that Moses is trying to get across to us is that the same words are used. So I've got a table, I think, here, Graham. Thank you. Verse 11. Moses sees the Egyptian beating a Hebrew. Later on, God says he sees the affliction and oppression of his people. Moses strikes down the Egyptian. At the Passover, God says he will strike down all the firstborns. Verse 17, Moses saves the women from the shepherds by the water. Chapter 14, God saves Israel through the water. Verse 19, they were delivered by Moses. Chapter 3, God says he will deliver them. Even more, just as Israelites will soon journey out of Egypt into the Sinai desert, so to hear Moses out into the desert as he flees to Midian. They're all clues. Sharon and Miv and I have a tradition. On a Sunday night, we watch the Antiques Roadshow, but the people are more interested in the antiques. And then we watch an episode of Agatha Christie's Poirot. Right? If you watch these murder mysteries, any murder mystery really, the clues to listen out for are the seemingly spurious details. You know, why did they keep going on about that blue vase or whatever it is? Well, it's the same here with Moses. Using those words are clues pointing forward to God's future work through Moses, except Agatha Christie or somebody will try and hide them amongst a load of red herrings. Moses is broadcasting them. So in all these ways, Moses wants us to see in his own story a little prototype of the rescue that God is soon to accomplish for his people. And even in that bigger story, that's anticipating the even bigger rescue we know through Jesus. And so we, with our 2020 vision hindsight, can see God bringing his plans together. But how is it going for those Hebrews left behind in Egypt? Verse 23. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. Great, things will get better now, won't they? No, the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out. And their cry for help, because of their slavery, went up to God. Went up to the God who remembers. Our next heading, the God who remembers. Now notice verse 23, it's not in faith they rationalize that they should be okay with their suffering because it's all part of God's plan. No, they cried out. Probably cried out things like, "Where are you, God? Being a slave sucks. Why are you making us suffer like this? We're dying here. Rescue us. We're supposed to be your people, but we're under the power of Pharaoh. He controls our every minute of our lives." God is, as we've been seeing in chapter 1 and 2, in control. He will fulfill his promises, but it's still the right response to cry out to him, honestly, from the heart. And then verse 24 gives us all the important clues to the rest of Exodus. It tells us really what it's all about. Verse 24, God heard their groaning and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, God decides now to leap into action. So to be clear, whenever we see God remembered in the Old Testament, it doesn't mean that God is a dodderly old fool like the Wizard of Oz and he just forgot the promises he made. You know, he's doing a bit of gardening and he hears this moaning from down in Egypt. Oh yeah, I made those promises, didn't I? Not like that at all. The covenant isn't a kettle that God forgot he'd put on. When God remembers, it always means this is the moment he has chosen in his perfect love and perfect knowledge to act, to intervene. God's remembering is God acting in his own timing. So remembering is a timing thing, not a memory thing for God. Right, so God's not forgetful. So God not only hears their cry, but he also remembers his covenant. Just as he remembered Noah in the ark and rescued him. The point is to show us that whatever comes next in Exodus is God keeping his promises to bless Abraham, to bless his offspring, and through them to bless the whole world. So in Exodus, in the rest of the Bible, there'll be plenty more trouble, plenty more strife, lots more hardship for God's people. But those struggles are only ever bit part players in God's plans. The worst things are never the last things. They never thwart God's plans. They sometimes serve God's plans. And God is always with his people to help them endure their suffering for his glory and for their blessing. Life is not pain or pain au chocolat. God hears our cries in both. He's concerned about them. He remembers. But back to how are these scriptures concerning Jesus? That's our next heading. How are these scriptures concerning Jesus? Well, many hundreds of years later, another Hebrew had a childhood not dissimilar to Moses' own. He too was the object of a king's hatred. He too fled to a foreign country in fear of his life. He too would be saved from Egypt. And you can read all of that about Jesus in Matthew chapter 2. He too would be the man chosen to be God's deliverer. He too would rescue God's people. This time, not from physical or political slavery, but rescue us from sin and death. And if you still think that's a bit of a stretch, connecting Exodus and Jesus, well, listen to what his young mother, Mary, sang about when she found out she was pregnant with him. What he was sending his son to do. Luke 1:54. He has helped his servant Israel, remembering to be merciful to Abraham and his descendants forever, just as he promised our ancestors. Jesus' own mother joins this direct line between God's promises and Jesus. Another place you'll find Moses in the New Testament is in Hebrews, the book of Hebrews. And the author of that holds Moses up as an example of faith. See what you think of this, bearing in mind what we've just read. Hebrews 11:24. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. I don't know. Maybe, I reckon if you'd read that, just Hebrews 11, without reading Exodus, you'd probably get quite a different impression of Moses, I think. I mean, but from Moses' point of view, he wasn't thinking of himself as a man of great faith. He was probably just doing the best he could, as faithfully as he could in the circumstances he found himself in. Well, that's the point. In the model of faith held up for us in the Bible, is trusting that God is at work in and through the good things and the bad things, through the pain and through the pain au chocolat, through things that very often seem they're just happening, mundane, drudgery. When you go through those things, holding on, even by just a thread, holding on to Jesus, what you're doing is living by faith. not the quality or the amount of your faith that counts. It's who your faith is in. Jesus has won. Jesus has done it all. Pharaoh and all he represents, opposition to God, Satan, evil, doesn't get to make a big comeback at the end. The fateful blow has been dealt on the cross. And until Jesus returns, God doesn't promise we'll be free from suffering or persecution. He doesn't promise health and wealth in this life for those who are faithful to him. And sometimes our lives will seem just as bonkers as Moses' life. Sometimes our lives will seem just as heartbreaking and scary as Moses' mum's life must have been. But Exodus shows us God, he doesn't wait and to make everything sweet and perfect, not some saccharine TV commercial, Instagram-worthy version of life, a kind of life we've got no experience of, and then keep his promises. God starts keeping his promises now, there, in amongst the pain and struggle of ordinary, everyday life, keeping his promises. God hears our cry. God cares about us, and he's remembered us in sending Jesus to be our perfect deliverer, ending our slavery to sin and death once and for all. So we can be confident God will keep his covenant promises, his new covenant promises, for something better for us, to bring us to the promised land of a new heaven and a new earth.